Prince Eddie Harris, by the way, the inventor of the electrified saxophone, and a bunch of his good buddies opening up Freedom Jazz Dance. It's from his 1965 album, The In Sound. Harris, of course, on tenor sax, Ray Codrington on trumpet, Cedar Walton on piano, Ron Carter on bass, and Billy Higgins on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, May the 7th, 2015, and a program I hope you find of interest and possibly even the basis for further discussion tomorrow on Free Your Mind Friday. Well, not to pat myself too generously on the back, but yesterday it happens to be the case that I was in tune with the news of the day, ahead of it, as a matter of fact, when I raised the question about police reform. And in two cities, the matter again surfaced in a pretty big way, in Baltimore and in Chicago. But let's look at what happened in Baltimore. How did it surface in Baltimore? Yesterday, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake, who had met with the U.S. Attorney General the previous day, yesterday formally petitioned the Justice Department to come into her fair city and take a very close look at its police department with an eye toward determining whether the department had engaged in or still is engaging in civil rights violations generally, but specifically as it relates to the case of Freddie Gray, the 25-year-old man who died on April the 19th, exactly a week after he was arrested by police under specious circumstances and sustained catastrophic injuries, including severed spinal cord, a crushed voice box, and other physical injuries. As you know, that touched off a rebellion in Baltimore and sympathetic demonstrations across the country. Mayor Rawlings Blake took the position that the federal government needs to come in, and so she made the announcement yesterday and confirmed it yesterday that indeed she has asked the U.S. Attorney General to come in and conduct an investigation. Well, this got a lot of coverage, very positive coverage. Even the mayor herself kind of congratulating herself for having the guts and the bravery and the courage to do this, because it is not normally the case that mayors would take on a police department this way and insist that the federal government come in and conduct a close examination of its operations. And truly, it was also seen in a wider sense to be a very bold move, a very courageous move. But I don't think so. Now, it doesn't matter what I think, really, but I just wanted to point out to you that there is a troubling underside to this story and this move. When a local official, such as the head of a city, like a mayor, as Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake, makes a petition that the federal government should come in, what ought to be expressed explicitly is that the mayor feels that the situation is beyond the capacity of the city to deal with. That should be said. It should not be implied that somehow by asking the federal government to come in, what the mayor is doing is essentially bringing in the big guns, when actually what the mayor is admitting is that there is a very, very clear sense of doubt about the ability of the city to take on this task. And that could only be because of the perceived power of the police department and its ability, basically, its immunity from being scrutinized and dealt with by any existing local authority. And further, that there's a great doubt, at least in the mind of the mayor, that justice will prevail even if local authorities were to assume the responsibility of doing the investigation itself. So, we ought to at least start there. The second thing is, and I want to just elaborate on the first point here, and that is, in the end, the police department, first and foremost, is under the direct authority and supervision of the local government, which, of course, is headed by the mayor of Baltimore. Mayor Rawlings Blake has direct authority, and the city council of the city of Baltimore has direct authority over the police department. So that when the mayor and the city council basically are yielding their authority, that is a huge statement of a belief that they don't have any confidence that they can take on this task and get justice, get results. That's a huge admission of the awesome power of the police department, that it can resist, any attempt at all by a duly constituted body to regulate it. That's huge. But of course, it's not being said. But that's what ought to be said. The third thing is, the people of Baltimore really deserve to have their will expressed via the apparatus of government that they elected first. But we see no attempt here by the city to actually engage the reforming of the department or the control, direct control of the department, calling it into accountability. There's no attempt at that, really. There is just simply a throwing up of the hands and saying, well, we'll call the feds in. Now, people would say, well, that's a very brave move. But really what it is passing the buck. They don't want to deal with a police department. It is not politically expedient for any elected official to go up against a police department, against the Fraternal Order of Police, against the police unions. They don't see it as being in their interest to do that. So they palm it off, or they choose to palm it off on the feds. Let them come in and deal with this headache. Because if we do, we're done. They have a lot of money at their disposal. They certainly have the backing of other police departments. And their political careers could be in jeopardy if they are seen as being antagonistic toward police. So they don't want to send the wrong signals, but they do want to be seen publicly as a very courageous person, as very courageous leaders, by calling in the feds, because there is this kind of myth that somehow the feds are a higher and greater power and authority, and calling them in is tantamount to saying, we want this thing solved once and for all, and the feds will do the job. When really what it is that they're giving up and yielding very easily without even a fight. Their power to control their police department. So the people of Baltimore are entitled to have the apparatus of government that they elected to do the job, in fact, to do the job. And if they don't want to do the job, or if they don't think they can do the job, that ought to be explicitly said. The next point I want to make about this is that we know what the pattern is when the feds come in and take a case like this over and supposedly conduct their investigations with an eye toward prosecutions. We just saw what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, where Eric Holder, the former U.S. Attorney General, just came in, performed a what I call not an investigative report, but did a corroborative report, a report that corroborated what people had been saying all these years, and just left it at that, saying, well, my job here is done, and basically, you guys figure out the rest. We have found rampant racism. We have found a plantation system here in operation. We have found that the police department, in fact, does target the African-American population of Ferguson. They found everything that people have been saying for years, and that was repeated to the investigators. So it was not really an investigative report, it was a corroborative report. And with the filing of the report, did not come any indictments or anybody basically being singled out, or no reforms of the police department to speak of. They just kind of left it there. Holder just left the report to stand as the department's position and the department's evidence of its investigation. So it is hardly likely that looking for the feds to come in, that we would see criminal indictments. In fact, Eric Holder himself said that he was not going to proceed with any criminal indictments because the standards are just too high. The standards are so high that it was going to be a futile effort to even attempt it. So in light of all of this, what then are we to make of this request for federal intervention into the operations of the police department with an eye toward whether the civil rights of Baltimoreans were being violated? You can see that it's a kind of a political hustle. It's a kind of game. Now, I'm not trying to condemn the mayor for doing this or asking for the federal government's involvement, but I'm saying that we should not be bamboozled. We should not lose sight of how these things ought to work. And when the call is made for the feds to come in, usually it is because local authorities do not wish to engage in doing the jobs that they were elected to do and exercising the authority and power they have to set things right. It is more politically expedient for them simply to pass the buck. So now we go to Chicago. And what do we find there? Yesterday, the City Council of Chicago unanimously approved a fund, oddly called a reparations fund, that would basically compensate victims of systematic torture in Chicago for well over two decades. I know, reparations, torture, these things are not supposed to be part of anybody's vocabulary in 2015, but in fact, they are. Because the city of Chicago has had no choice but to come to terms with the fact that its police department has been a renegade operation for decades. And finally, when it could not ignore it any longer, when it could not deny it any longer, when it could not fight it any longer, because the evidence was so overwhelming that the police department and this one particular individual, Police Commander John Burge, and the people under his command, who routinely tortured people they arrested, forcing them to make confessions that resulted in high conviction rates. Well over 200 people, most of them African-American men. It reached a point where the evidence was so overwhelming, John Burge was actually convicted of the crimes of torture, but sentenced to only 4.5 years, and he didn't even serve all 4.5 years. He actually got out of federal prison just last year on the basis of good behavior. Meanwhile, the lives of the men who were systematically tortured were just, you know, casualties. They were just casualties, and the city for a long time literally fought against admission of guilt. Finally, when it was so overwhelming that it just could not fight it any longer, then the charges were lodged against John Burge. So the city of Chicago decided yesterday that it would put about $5 million into a pool, a fund that would be disbursed to victims who can prove that they were in fact victims of torture by John Burge and his men. Lots of political speeches being made about what a great day it was for Chicago. Here's Chicago righting a historic wrong and all of that. But we still look at the matter. $5 million stretched over 200 plus people who might have been tortured systematically by members of Chicago's police department under the commander, John Burge. It's really not a lot of money. So even as Chicago professes that it is doing the right thing, it is still getting off pretty cheap. For one thing, the pot of money, $5 million, is nothing if you consider the severity of the charges and the impact and consequences on the victims. But more than that, we have the unaddressed matter of how was it that John Burge, whose systematic torture programs began in the 1970s and ended in the 1990s, and these things were known. This is not new information. These things were known. But the city conspired to simply ignore it because the victims were African Americans and deemed to be perfectly expendable. You don't need to worry too much about that. And we did not see the reform of the police department. We did not see the reform of the prosecutor's office. We did not see the reform of the judicial system, all of which conspired, of course, to keep this case absolutely under the radar. But we have the public officials waxing philosophic yesterday, including the recently re-elected Rahm Emanuel, basically extolling what a wonderful outcome this has been, what a great outcome, because here is Chicago standing up for justice. It has thrown $5 million, a whopping $5 million, into a pool of money that will now set things straight and cleanse Chicago of its stain of torture. So you can see why, you know, there is a hesitancy on my part to embrace any of this as movement toward justice, movement toward reform. You see the same games being played over and over again. And it is because the victims of these actions by rogue cops and an out of control police departments are people of color. And they come from communities that are seen as powerless and politically unprotected. It's all well and good when, you know, people stand up and take credit at the ceremonial moment and they wax philosophic and they say the right things. But the record shows an absolute aversion to engaging in the business of justice, engaging with these police departments, calling the police commissioners to account, calling them on the carpet, subjecting them to continuous review, subjecting the members of the police department to continuous monitoring and review. Because these are the communities that are absorbing the brunt of lethal consequences. It is their lives that are lost more often than anybody else's. It is their communities that are targeted. It is their rights that are trounced. It is their lives that are snuffed out. So I come back to the question about reforms. Who is doing all of this reforming? What is it looking like, considering that we see how the bureaucracy is responding? The people who are in charge, the people who are supposed to lead these reforms, are yielding to all kinds of other incentives. And the largest incentive, of course, is political survival. Rahm Emanuel, one of the most hated mayors of Chicago, is able to redeem himself with a mere $5 million that would be dispersed to victims of systematic torture, by record, more than 200 of them, and he comes out smelling really clean. Not only that, the first ceremony he performs is expunging blame from the city and its police department and not at all associating any of that history with what is currently happening in Chicago now. So we have a historical erasure also going on, because with this fund of reparations, this reparations fund, the city of Chicago is now to be seen as starting off a new leaf, historically. With this fund and with compensation to some of the victims, the city of Chicago expunges itself of blame for what is currently happening and what is likely to happen in the future. Similarly, in Baltimore, merely by asking for the federal government to come in, the city of Baltimore essentially would have been able to say, for the record, we called in the feds. And that pretty much is where we are. The feds have been called. It is now up to them. We have done our job. we issued the call. When we know, of course, the job is to take on the police department. But they don't want to do that. So I raise this question in this context to basically remind you that even in the middle of all of these tragedies and travesties, we have the political system still functioning the way it is accustomed to functioning, which is to divert and mask and avoid and do everything except really deal with the problem of systemic reform. There is no reason, they see, that they should do that because it involves huge political risks. And the first order of business in politics is survival. They are not about to trade in their political survival for the mere business of justice. They're not about to take on a headache. They're not about to go toe-to-toe with any police department. So you look at a city like New York, for example, where we have seen more than our fair share. We've seen hundreds of cases of police brutality and excessive use of force. And despite the fact that you can look at the statistics and see that there is a systemic problem here, it will be denied. It will be denied. Because the mayor or the governor will have absolutely no interest in antagonizing the police department. The mayor of the city of New York and the city council of New York should have Commissioner Bratton, the police commissioner, on the carpet, questioning him publicly about how this department is being run. Why is it that millions and millions of dollars are being paid to New Yorkers who have, in one way or the other, been negatively impacted by the police? How does he account for the day-to-day operations? How does he account for the increasing percentage of rogue cops within the department? How does he account for the fact that the department can't seem to police itself and causing great havoc among the citizens of the city? Well, these, of course, are very troubling kinds of questions, and so they will not be asked. Why? Because political expediency, and the first order of business is political survival. So, yesterday I raised the question, and we had the answer. We got it from Baltimore, and we got it from Chicago. Different circumstances, but the same response. How about that? Well, during my little hiatus there for a moment, I wanted to present a very, very important program to you that has to do with the First Nations, and I want to present that to you today, just to make up, and this would square us easily with backlogged programs that we didn't get to hear. This is a program of a talk by the noted Caribbean novelist, playwright, poet, political activist, environmentalist, and scholar historian Jan Carew. A friend of mine, he passed away recently, and an extraordinary figure, a major luminary, not just in the Caribbean, but he is most well associated with the Caribbean, but just an incredibly wonderful person and a great scholar across the board. In this talk, he tackles white supremacist historiography. He tackles it head on in this riveting presentation on the Seminole Wars. The Seminole Wars were an incredible point of American history, and we are about to learn about the significance of the Seminole Wars from this excerpt of his talk about how African runaway slaves who found safe harbor among the First Nations of Florida united with them in a protracted battle against the pro-slavery Confederacy and the slavocracy of the South. Here is Dr. Jan Carew, spelled J-A-N-C-A-R-E-W. Enjoy.
One of the interesting things about white historiography, this Eurocentric historiography, it hones in always on the things that separate us. They separate us from ourselves. They separate us from our ancestors, from our history, from our families. They divide us up into little fragments. And they never tell you about the unities in struggle that took place in history. And so my historiography hones in just on this point. Because the logic of the situation is that if people were oppressed, like the Native Americans were and the African ancestors were, obviously they resisted the oppression. And obviously, as intelligent human beings, it occurred to them that by uniting against a common foe, they would have greater strength in the struggle. But the histories lie there waiting generation after generation. And then I pick up the books by Boyd Thatcher, who is a great admirer of Columbus. But in those books I find that in 1502 there is a rebellion, a major rebellion, in which blacks and Native Americans join forces. 1492 to 1502. That's 10 years. And in that time begins a struggle. And you're going to find this uniting of the oppressed threading its way through the entire history for 5 centuries. And one of the great epics of the struggle took place in, of all places, in Florida. You know, we have black studies departments all over the country, and do you know, I have seen not one single piece about this to train our children, because the way you defeat someone, you defeat them in the mind first. That's why Garvey said, first you must change your way of thinking, and then peacefully carve up the weapons with which to fight. So they assault the mind. They tell you about rebellions that Nat Turner and Denmark Vesey and Posner. But if you notice, all of them were betrayed. They didn't win. And the one great insurgency that blacks fought in this country for over 130 years is one of the best kept secrets in black history. And it took place in Florida, and you read about it as the Seminole Wars. You've heard about that, haven't you? Seminole Wars? Do you know that there's no such thing as a Seminole? Seminole doesn't exist. Seminole was a Creek word for runways. And those slaves who escaped from the Carolinas and from Virginia down through what eventually became Georgia. Georgia became a state to block the movement of escaped slaves into Florida. Did you know that? That's how they set it up, as in quotes, a free state. And there in Florida, the blacks were called Seminoles first, black escapees who went into Florida, who were welcomed by the Native Americans there. And there you had some of the most interesting Native Americans in the entire hemisphere. There was a group called the Calusas, and the Tequestas, and the Apalaches, and even their enemies write about them with respect, because they were some really bad Native Americans. I mean, they... When Ponce de Leon came, and you know we have at the Exploratorium a film on Cabeza de Vaca, this who went with the Narvaez expedition, and I'm going to, interesting to see how they're going to do this film. How I learned about the resistance there in Florida is that you have to read a book by a half Native American who was related to the Inca kings. His name was Poma de Ayala. And he had oral testimony from soldiers who had actually fought in Florida. And when Ponce de Leon arrived there, he arrived like a conquistador. And I must tell you quickly how he arrived. It was the Taino pilots who showed him how to navigate those treacherous waters of the Bahamas. Bahama comes from Spanish Bahamar, the shallow sea. And then you anglicize it as Bahamas. So in there you can wreck your ships every second. And the Taino pilots, who were brilliant at navigation and at astronomy and at looking, the science of looking at the motion of waves and judging the distances from land, which, you know, only recently the Smithsonian had some white scholar discover that those black folks in the Pacific were navigating the entire Pacific Ocean in their catamaran boats, and they could look at the motion of the waves and the wind and tell the distances from land in that big, vast Pacific. So this is what the Tainos taught to Ponce de Leon, and he got past that Bahama current and he got to Florida. He immediately fell on the Native Americans and began slaughtering them after they welcomed him. These murderous Spanish and genocidal Spaniards. And what the Calusas did, they waited for him to come back. And then they feted, wined, and dined them for 4 days. And then they fell upon them and killed every single one. They left six alive, but barely alive. They wounded them so that the wound would work in enough time when they got back to Cuba to spread the word. Don't come back here. There's some serious folk here. And of course, they never learned, so they came back again. Ponce de Leon, we told, you know, he went to look for the Fountain of Youth. They ended his search. 6 days after he arrived in Cuba, he died from the wounds that the Calusas had put upon him. What that did for the Calusas, they learnt instantly the logistics of making special arrows that could neutralize the power of horses. They made special bows and arrows with special trajectories and force, and they would put their archers in the trees, and they could shoot an arrow right through the body of a horse. So when you read about how the Indians, you know, the Indians in quote, were terrified of horses, the Calusas dealt with the horses. And then with armor, after killing the Ponce de Leon fellows in armor. They took the armor, they stuffed it with straw, they hung it up on a tree, and they found every weak spot through which their spears and arrows could go. So when the Spaniards came back, they were ready for them. They could take care of the armor, they could take care of the horses, and they were more brilliant tacticians in their own land. They could lure. So Alion goes next. And again, he went to a different part of the northern Florida coast. And when he was there, these Apalaches welcomed him, gave them food and drink. And then Alion invited about 300 of the Native Americans on the ships. And when they came aboard, they simply battened down the hatches and started taking them away as slaves. And every single one of them committed suicide before they got to Cuba, rather than face enslavement and this terrible act of treachery. And then Alion made the mistake of going back again. And this time they were ready for him. Once again they feted wine and dined. And they said to him, Alion, why are you fighting for this distant monarch across the sea? We are warriors, and we would have more respect for you if you came looking out for yourself and your people here. We could share some things with you and show you some techniques of surviving here. Anyway, when the Calusas were finished with Alion, he and about three others managed to get back to Puerto Rico. For 100 years, the Native Americans in Florida kept the European settlers at bay. You hear about Herman de Soto, how de Soto discovered the Mississippi. De Soto was utterly and totally defeated by those Native Americans. I'm telling you this because the tradition of resistance filtered into the blacks who were coming in now into Florida and who were going to write one of the great epic chapters of a struggle in the Colombian era. And you are told in the history books about two Seminole wars. The first, the blacks were called Seminoles. Then when the Creek Nation broke up and Sacafaca took his group over the border into Florida, these Creeks were called Seminoles. So there's no cohesive or logical Seminole. It was a word used to describe the people who had come into Florida from the north. And that alliance of the Native Americans and the Africans in Florida held in spite of every effort to break it. You heard about Osceola. Many black people call their children Osceola. Osceola married a black woman. And when he went to have talks with Thompson, General Thompson, at the Fort Gaines, slave catchers captured his wife. And his wife in the Seminole language was called Cochicher, which means morning dew. And this sister was a fighter, because the slave catcher who took her, the news came out after that she killed him and committed suicide. But Osceola swore that he would avenge this black woman's capture. And Thompson, the general, he and his men followed him for 2 years. And one night after Thompson had a good dinner and was coming out of his veranda, they filled him with about 14 shots from their rifles. And Osceola, after he fell, shouted, you know, "I remember the hour," he said. So we have to remember ours too, you see. No black woman was ever defended in a war in this hemisphere until Osceola fought. He fought, the first Seminole War was fought over that capture of Cochitere. And amongst these groups, you know, you know how we get the research about the Seminole Wars? You have to go to New England, into the libraries, and into the parish records. And there are letters from white soldiers who were fighting in Florida, who wrote home about what was happening. Because it was a felony for any journalist to mention that blacks were fighting in Florida. That's why you don't know about it. And that fight went on. And amongst the great leaders who emerged was Abraham. He is one of the great black leaders in this North American history. All of the whites who write about Abraham, even though they hate him, write about him with respect. Abraham was a brilliant man, a brilliant fighter, a brilliant tactician. He knew several languages, and he was one of the chief negotiators. See, while the Spanish owned Florida, Abraham knew that they could stay free. But when the United States bought Florida in 1819, they knew now that the whole might of the United States was going to be turned against them. And that's exactly what happened. By the late 1840s, two-thirds of all the United States armed forces were fighting against black and Seminole insurgents in Florida. Two-thirds. Over 50,000 troops. It's the greatest war in which the U.S. fought until Vietnam. And Abraham at one point called his followers together and said, "We are fighting for the liberation of all oppressed peoples in this hemisphere. We will never sign a treaty with our enemies." And the whole nation had to vote, and one faction voted that they would sign a treaty. And Abraham and Atlasa, or Tiger Cat, he was called in the Coacoochee, in the Seminole language, it means Tiger Cat. He was Abraham's counterpart among the Native Americans. And they left Florida when the whole, after defeating over and over again some of the mightiest of the armies the U.S. had mounted, including now Schlesinger, that historian, writes a biography of Jackson, Andrew Jackson, Stonewall Jackson. Do you know that the blacks in Florida wasted Jackson? He fought at Suwannee. There, that small town, Suwannee is a Seminole word, which means the river of reeds. And there, Atlasa and Abraham met Jackson's forces, and Abraham begged for the right to be the first to attack them. So he held the right wing, and they tore to pieces Jackson's forces. And he was frothing with rage. Here were blacks who he believed were inferior. Some of the tactics they used, they played on Jackson's racism. They sent some blacks in front to look as though they were minstrels. They were chewing and playing banjo and jiving around. And so Jackson let his guard down, you know, so he's coming on now to wipe these blacks off the face of the earth. And right there in those hammocks were waiting the highly trained troops of Abraham. And Jackson now, to take his revenge, this is not, you're not going to find that in your history book by Schlesinger, but this is a fact. He went to the settlement where they had left the women and children, and there he fell upon them and slaughtered them. And the history books tell you he won a great victory. And Abraham and his troops and his Seminole comrades had disappeared. And Jackson's advisors told him, if you want to be president of the United States, there are some really bad blacks here in Florida, and they will ruin your reputation to such a point you never make it to the presidency. So get out of here now. And he left, and he didn't come back. So then Abraham and Atlasa took their whole communities to Oklahoma. And there once again they tried to trick them. They kept their arms. They never gave up their arms. And when they saw that once again they're being surrounded and tricked, I'm giving you a very encapsulated history, and I want you to go away feeling better. They fought from Oklahoma all the way into southern Mexico, into northern Mexico, in Coahuila, that border state, where there were about 3,000 black maroons already to welcome them. They had escaped from the slavery in Texas and those border states. And Atlasa and Abraham lived there with their communities. Now the Texas legislature felt you couldn't have blacks like this, of such renowned fighters, living across the border while the slave system is still rampant in this country. So these macho Texas Rangers now set out to go and finish off these blacks. The only reports I have of that is a Texas paper which says the two expeditions that went returned with their numbers greatly reduced. And Abraham died in bed, you know, there in Coahuila, near a town called Santa Rosa on that Mexican border. And if you go there, I have been there, you can see the descendants of those black Seminoles. You know, you can't hide the features and the blood, it shows. And there you see these larger folk who are ranchers and living there still. And they were given land and freedom by Juarez, the first Native American president of Mexico. He's a full-blooded Indian, Juarez. He gave to these black fighters because he knew they were such renowned fighters, they would prevent incursions from North America. So there was a quid pro quo thing. These are the things that we have to deal with in the Colombian era. Inside of that era, we have fought endless battles. And one of the things that we avoid in the history, and that we should learn from it, you know, when Osceola fights for Cochiter to make those who would dishonor our women pay for it, as Mao Zedong says, in blood. It's telling us a lesson about equality in the perception of our human beings, of males and females. And we have great weaknesses in this still in our camp.